Bon, donc, pour terminer la série d'interventions, on a l'intervention du professeur David Roxburgh de Harvard University, Proliferation of Duplicates, New Technologies of the Image in Qajar, Iran. Monsieur Roxburgh est donc, comme je viens de vous dire, professeur dans le département d'histoire de l'art et d'architecture à Harvard University, où il a enseigné depuis assez longtemps. Il est Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, Professor of Islamic Art History. Il est l'auteur de plusieurs publications, dont par exemple on vient de citer The Persian Album 1400-1600, qu'il a publié en 2005, puis Prefacing the Image, The Writing of Art History in 16th Century Iran. Et il a plusieurs projets aussi en cours. Et en plus, il a aussi été le directeur d'un certain nombre d'expositions, comme par exemple celle sur les Turcs, Journey of a Thousand Years en 2005, et ainsi de suite. Donc, il va nous parler de quelque chose qui va nous amener donc vers la fin de l'époque moderne. Donc, chronologiquement, ça nous amène jusqu'au bout de notre voyage d'aujourd'hui, portant donc sur l'Iran des Qajars.
Thank you, Sanjay. Thank you to the Collège de France and to the audience for staying so late on a Friday afternoon. So the most complete foreign account of nearly all aspects of life in late 19th century Iran under the rule of the Qajar dynasty was written by Lord George Curzon. He visited Iran for 4 months between September 1889 and January 1890. In the early years of his political career, he traveled widely throughout Iran and published an expansive two-volume narrative of his journey in 1892, Persia and the Persian Question. Curzon described an Iran still stuck in the throes of what he regarded to be an incipient and incomplete modernization process, then led by the Qajar ruler Nasser ad-Din Shah. Initially a reformist monarch, he'd already grown wary of and become dissatisfied by the socio-political effects and implications of modernization. During his time in Tehran, Curzon toured the Gulistan Palace, the seat of the dynasty, and was struck by the many buildings making up palace and grounds, and noted their diverse styles, built and decorated in the Persian manner, with adaptations of European forms and motifs. One of Curzon's lengthiest descriptions is given to the Talari Salam, a reception hall whose primary function was to serve as a museum that safeguarded royal treasure and the gifts given by foreign potentates to the Qajar Shahs. The two-story structure featured a facade decorated with glazed tiles in the seven-colored half-drangi technique, punctuated by rounded windows and a porch supported by fluted columns with capitals. A broad carpeted staircase led to a second floor with the new museum located on the left. A great hall or gallery constructed after the return of the Shah from his first visit to Europe in 1873. Curzon's impression of Tehran's inchoate urban fabric continues in his narration of the museum. This extraordinary chamber, with its contents alternately resembling an Aladdin's palace, an old curiosity shop, a prince's wardrobe, and a municipal museum, consists of a long parallelogram crowned by a series of low domes with plaster decoration in white, blue, and gold, there being a number of deep recesses terminating in windows along one side, while the partition between these recesses and the remaining walls of the room are fitted with glass cases, in which are displayed, side by side, treasures of priceless value and the most unutterable rubbish. The central part of the chamber, which is in part tile-paved, contains a number of immense porcelain vases, mostly from Europe, candelabra, lusters, armchairs covered with a thin plating of real gold, etc., whilst upon tables or under glass cases are disposed with some slight effort at arrangement, but in ludicrous juxtaposition, Swiss musical boxes, Persian antiquities, and specimens, meteorites, European purchases or presents, and heads of game shot by His Majesty. In his comprehensive narration, Curzon oscillates between outright awe and judgmental dismay. Impressed by countless jewels, pearls, armor, and swords, and a vast collection of European porcelains from Sèvres, Dresden, and Worcester, he found the oil paintings mediocre or execrable. After the museum's vaulted hall, Curzon passed through a series of chambers that he considered to offer a, quote, farcical contrast of the Oriental and European. Quote, illustrations snipped from the English illustrated newspapers appear side by side upon the walls with photographs of the Shah and his little boy favorite, the Aziz Sultan, and with inferior copies of Italian oil paintings. Here is a picture of the Paris exhibition and the Eiffel Tower. There is a deplorable oleograph of an Alpine village, both hung in a room adorned with Persian plasterwork and spread with Persian carpets. I noticed here what I observed in other palaces that I visited, that the Oriental intellect seems to derive particular gratification from the display of duplicates. Thus, the king's son, the Zilli Sultan, has in his town residence a long row of facsimile portraits of himself hanging upon a single wall. Similarly, in the royal abode, I noticed in one place two large copies of a semi-nude Venus or Magdalene of the later Italian school, absolutely identical, hanging on either side of a doorway, and the same phenomenon was constantly repeated. The impression left upon me by an inspection of many modern Persian residences of size and magnificence was this, that whereas the Persian taste, if restricted to its native art or to the employment of native style, seldom errs, the moment it is turned adrift into a new world, all sense of perspective, proportion, or beauty, all aesthetic perception, in fact, appears to vanish. And in proportion as its choices will have been correct and refined amid native materials, so does it become vulgar and degraded abroad. Such judgments offered by European visitors to Iran were entirely conventional and frequently repeated. In his memoir of 1867, Mr. Julien Comte de Rochechouart, who was in Iran from 1863, succeeding Joseph Arthur Comte de Gobineau at the French legation in Tehran, had already seized upon what he held to be strange and unwelcome traits in the arts of the Qajar period. The Persians have no idea about painting as we think of it, and what is more, they do not understand it. Persian rulers have been heard speaking many times about the value we attach to this art and have requested paintings and sent students to study in Rome. But the paintings that they bring them are loathsome, and the students sent to Europe learn nothing and return saying, to explain their ignorance, that we have nothing in painting that is remarkable, and that the last street sweeper of Tehran knows better how to hold a brush than Raphael or Titian. Although the seated Madonna has found grace before Raphael and Titian, the Persian artist Persianized it before reproducing it. At first, she was not so décolleté, then changed the palette. It takes a lot of goodwill to identify the model. Elsewhere, Rochechouart dismisses the Persians as orientalists, as ornamentalists, noting that their painting, quote, is an utterly industrial art form entirely outside the aesthetic norms to which we are accustomed. He further asserts that their traditional art is in decline and observes that artists have as their models images of Lorraine that garnish the shop windows of our village wig makers, or lithographs that decorate the rooms in taverns. Asia, Africa, Nina, Matilda's smile, a fire in the new world, and even worse, lewd engravings of the sort only sold in the back street shops of certain neighborhoods of Paris. The subjects he identifies reflect types found in lithographs and chromolithographs made by such popular print factories as Jean-Charles Pellerin at Épinal. A broad range of materials reached Iran from Europe and Russia during the 1800s, including printed works on paper, comprising newspapers, books, postcards, and prints, as well as cottons. And in these examples here, you'll see how the chromolithographs were cut out and glued into painted ensembles and domestic interiors, or these portraits of women here that were cut out from advertisements. So we have some sense of what happened to this imported material, at least in an Iranian context. Separated by two decades, Curzon and Rosh Hashuar were struck by what they deemed to be the harmful effects of European art on the national, indigenous, traditional arts of Iran, as well as the Persians' failure to draw or perhaps understand the kinds of distinctions Europeans would commonly make between elite and popular art forms, their different mediums, and characteristic means and manners of execution. Across social ranks, Qajar artists and patrons alike freely embraced the products of the newest technologies of representation, lithography, chromolithography, and photography, and the capacities of the mass-produced image, which they held in equal esteem to the conventional and historical mediums of drawing and painting, encompassing watercolor, oil painting, and lacquer, made directly by the human hand. But even more than that, Qajar artists, whether working under court patronage or in the bazaars, engaged in a process of artistic creation that elided differences between discrete mediums, translating in the sense of moving something from one place or condition to another, recycling and repurposing images and subjects in a wholly fluid and elastic way. The repeated image and the utter preponderance of duplication perplexed Curzon. He couldn't fathom what he considered to be inherent redundancy in the frequent display of duplicates, perhaps because it challenged his cultural expectations of artistry, mastery, originality, good taste, and the exercise of judgment. Whether willfully or not, his opinion depended on a suspension of history, seeing in the Persian exposure and reaction to European art and newly developed technologies of representation a stark rupture rather than a continuity of artistic attitudes and procedures. In fact, the history of art in Iran, especially since the era of the Safavids, had been characterized by a receptivity to exogenous traditions, especially European ones, and a manner of conceiving of creativity and originality always through relational models. So images of whatever type, format, and medium had always been about images, a modus operandi that remained constant throughout Qajar times. An entirely different view of art, of the affair of the image, was voiced by Muhammad Hassan Khan Ehtimad al-Sultana, who died in 1896, court chronicler in Nasiruddin Shah's reign. In the section of his book devoted to progress in art, Taraki Nakashi, from his Kitab al-Ma'asir wa al-Asar, he stated that photography had been of particular advantage to the arts in Iran because it afforded valuable instruction in modeling and perspective. Quote, since photography was discovered, it has been of great service to the art of design, sanaati tasvir, the art of landscape rendering, durname sazi, of portraiture, Shabi Kashi, of light and shade, Vani Mudan Sayava Roshan, and the use of the laws of perspective, Kanuni Tanasob, as well as other aspects of this technique, Vasayer Nokati'in Fan Hami as Axe. All have found their originality and have been perfected. The years between Rosh Hashuar's and Ehtimad al-Sultana's statements, spanning the long reign of Nasiruddin Shah, witnessed a rapid expansion not only in imported images and image technologies, but also in the entirely fluid and mobile systems by which images moved across media in Qajar lands. Though recent scholarship has given the art of the Qajar period the serious consideration it merits, some of the prejudice and criticism expressed by the likes of Rosh Hashuar and Curzon has found its way into a formative academic discourse and continues today, fortunately, in reduced measure. In different ways, 19th century Europeans commented on the aesthetics, practices, and production of Persianate painting, including oil and canvas, watercolor and paper, and lacquer of the Qajar period to draw contrasts with European norms. But they also confronted evidence of intersections between the practice of painting and new technologies of image production and reproduction. A key question posed by European writers stemmed from their ideas of what constituted artistic authenticity in the face of Persian exposure to and emulation of images formed in Europe and imported to Iran. The results of these responses were always considered detrimental. Writers of the period spanning the time of Rosh Hashuar and Curzon, and a few art historians since, identified exchanges between Europe and Iran as causing the demise of a historical Persianate painting, a long decline identified by some as beginning in the Safavid period of the early 1600s. From the perspective of a decline model, the inventions of photography and lithography and their assimilation into Qajar art only precipitated a deeper sense of loss and nostalgia for an irrecoverable native Persian tradition. Another approach to artistic innovation under the Qajars frames the artist's choice as a problem of modernity and in an emerging discourse in the disciplines of visual culture, studies, and history of art tend to focus on photography. For example, although Iranians eagerly embrace photography and its technical innovations demonstrated in these watercolors on the screen, Ali Behdad accepts Europe's a priori ownership of the medium and positions Qajar-era photographers as co-opted agents who could only reproduce a way of seeing and showing the East in Western terms. Whatever value such binaries might possess is, of course, absolutely questionable. Such was the power of Orientalism that native Persian photography was, quote, indebted to and mimetic of Orientalism's aesthetic values and ideological assumptions. Behdad even argues for the displacement of painting by photography during Nasser ad-Din Shah's reign, a shift of emphasis and priority that he considered to be embodied in the watercolor on the left of about 1853, which he interpreted as signifying the painter's anxiety at being displaced by the photographer. We can return to that. Both of these views turn around the idea of a rupture, a watershed in artistic tradition and practice, instantiated by mounting exposure to European art, culture, and technology. And yet neither of these perspectives is grounded in close study of the broad range of visual materials, from objects made through or under the auspices of elite institutions and courtly patrons, to those fashioned in the bazaar and purchased by members of a general public, objects that manifest highly complex intersections of media, as well as their remediation. How were lithographic and photographic images assimilated, remediated, and recast in and through the medium of painting? And what can we make of such processes? Examples abound of images fashioned in one medium emulated in another, a process that deeply troubled most 19th century European visitors to Iran. In the case of lacquer wares, not just yet, these include subjects adopted from European engravings and rendered in opaque watercolor under tinted varnish, as well as the direct use of prints that were selected, trimmed, and pasted onto the paper substrate of lacquered objects. The same processes were applied to the photograph shortly after its invention. One of the most striking examples of the direct use of a photograph is this pen box with applied photographs of Nasser ad-Din Shah and his family on the lid, with views of Tehran and Paris on the sides, which were trimmed and then attached to the wooden box and then lacquered. The restrained decoration used to complete the object, floral scrolls and cartouche of Persian poetry written in cursive Nastaliq script, alternating between gold and black and gold, complements the monochrome palette of the photographs. Another example of photography under lacquer, but one that produces a different effect, consists of portraits of Prince Dost Mohammad Khan Muayyar al-Mamalik attached to the binding of a divan of Poetry by Hakim Manuchehri Damghani, dated 1877. While the varnish, ornamental scrolls, and epigraphic borders maintain the inherent monochrome of the mass-produced image, here the lacquer has an overall softening effect and transmutes the hard-edged photograph into something resembling a fully handmade thing. The refractive properties of the coloured varnish render the photograph painterly. And of course, also implicated in this transformation is the better known fact that the compositions of Poe's highly controlled studio photography emulated the conventions of oil painting. Other objects resulted from layered systems of material translation, some of which are difficult to disentangle. The graphic techniques of lithographs, which were themselves made after and often simulated the qualities of paintings, drawings, prints, and photographs, are often found in ceramic tiles. The choice of a monochrome palette in the face of easy access to polychrome offers the strongest evidence in this example of lithographic or photographic media as objects of reference. These selected examples I've just shown demonstrate some of the outcomes of cross-medium interaction and show that Qajar artists were not troubled by the new technologies of image production, particularly photography. Another important question concerns the idea that photography was heralded as the epitome of modernity and presented a double challenge to the East. Photography not only held a reproductive potential, but it also seemed to naturalize perspective and the kind of optically naturalist modes of representation characteristic of European painting. Qajar artists' responses to mechanically produced and reproducible images can be understood as yet another instance of the assimilation of reproductive technologies, yet other remediations in effect, and hence can equally be characterized as a continuity and not a break with past working methods. Aside from emerging ideas about what it meant to be modern and the means by which modernity was signaled, the proliferation of repeated images made possible through technologies scalable to mass production can be understood as conceptually and practically systemic to Persianate art. In other words, artists largely continued to work in ways that they had before their exposure to the latest technologies of the image birthed in European centers. The principal shift lay in certain aesthetic outcomes of those exchanges as they crossed from one medium to another. Useful though they are, even positive assessments of the impact of lithography and photography on painting tend to neglect the specific formal features of Qajar paintings and reproduce, in uncritical ways, recurring themes of contemporary writing. Namely, that Qajar artists merely attempted to assimilate European pictorial conventions, reproduced their chosen prototypes, and relied on photographs as instruments of instruction. These observations give little emphasis to a crucial fact. Paintings made after photographic or lithographic models, themselves regarded as intermediaries, were never direct reproductions, but in specific ways exhibit traces, material and visual memories of their models. So what of the practice of painting in the second half of the 19th century? Some scholars have suggested the slow eclipse of painting after the advent of photography, while others have argued for the continuity of painting at the court and in other contexts. The position of chief painter, Nakashbashi, continued under Nasser al-Din Shah even as elite interest in photography intensified. Photography had been introduced to Iran in 1842 through gifts made by Queen Victoria and Tsar Nicholas, with a building devoted to it on the palace grounds, the Akas-Khani Mubaraki Humayuni, in 1862, and the Office of Court Photographer, Akasbashi, created in 1863. The chief painter's mandate included oversight of the royal workshops, Majmal Darul Sanai, founded in 1850, and the guilds in the city's bazaar, as well as instructing the ruler in painting. So painting continued to be practiced in a variety of venues, formats, and media, ranging from life-sized panel painting in oil to enamels, lacquer objects, paintings and manuscripts, and lithographed books, though the rupture paradigm obscures such continuities in practice. Founded in 1851, the Abode of Sciences, Dar al-Funun, was initially conceived as an instrument to develop knowledge of Western science and military training to modernize Iran through internal reform. By the 1860s, the curriculum adjusted its emphasis toward non-military subjects to include photography, lithography, painting, and music. Photography was added in 1860 and located in the Department of Chemistry, and painting in 1861. What we know of pedagogy in the Dar al-Funun points to the close intersection of painting, photography, and lithography from around 1860 onward. Painters' use of photographs as prototypes is amply attested, and there are even a few examples that can be matched as a pair, such as the salt print portrait of Nasser ed-Din Shah, dated to roughly 1852-55, and a watercolour done after it from about 1855. It's clear that we cannot take the watercolour painting for a photograph and cannot treat it simply as a coloured tinted photograph. Visual study of the watercolour leaves one questioning how the photograph could have imparted lessons in shading and modelling, while the tightly framed composition abrogates the understanding of perspective given that signs of spatial recession are eliminated. Artistic incompetence does not explain away this issue, as several other paintings attest. The photograph supplied data about relative scale, the outline of a figure, possible compositional elements, an imported spindle chair but not a backdrop, and a skein of lit and shaded passages. The translation toward a painting required not only an imagined palette and invention of pattern, but also a choice of which tonal passages to mimic, which to invent, and which to ignore. The single sheet portrait, mostly of a single figure, posed in an interior setting, of which the last example is one, among many, was one of the most common formats adopted by Qajar artists. It had a deep history in Persianate painting and had been thoroughly developed during the reign of Fath Ali Shah. Generally, those early 19th century depictions showed the Qajar ruler in an interior space with any background architecture parallel to the picture plane. Spatial depth was sometimes suggested by the receding but also parallel lines of objects, such as a throne or a carpet, shown axonometrically, or by cutaway views from an interior to the exterior. Elements of the painting tradition, long since adopted from European art, included an increased emphasis on the individual traits of physiognomy and the effects of light and shade. But none of these systems was applied systematically through the entire matrix of the image. Visible effects of light and shade or spatial recession, for example, were applied locally, affecting selected composition components of the image. And while the subject's face might suggest realism, intentional distortions in the proportion of the body, a slender waist, broad shoulders, reflected Qajar physiognomic ideals. A group of single sheet portraits from the 1850s, many of them by Abul Hasan Ghafari Kashani, demonstrate adaptations to the earlier Qajar paradigm. Rather than setting the figure in a space parallel to the pictorial space, the corner of a room is now frequently depicted, a window opening revealing an outdoor landscape, and the point of contact between the walls usually obscured by the sitter and furnishings. The framing of the image is tight and the space is tipped up, heightening a sense of intimacy. The figure stands or sits in a setting that is decorated with lavish floor and wall coverings, painted dados with borders and patterned drapes, and often furnished with a table and other objects. In a painting made shortly after his return from training in Europe, Abul Hasan Ghafari depicts Prince Ardashir Mirza, complete with all the elements of spatial construction outlined above. The work carries a customary inscription in Nastaliq script, identifying the subject by name and titles and providing the artist's signature. Prince Ardeshir Mirza dominates the composition, his volume and space conveyed through a tonal modelling integrated with networks of rich patterning and fields of flat colour. Close attention is paid to the texture of the face and the beard, and the subtle execution of the face and hands is achieved. But for an artist trained in the West, it cannot be accepted as a complete assimilation of post-Renaissance artistic conventions. Consider the handling of linear perspective and the basic incongruities of spatial logic, nor as a full imitation of a painted or a photographic model. Despite our perception of a volume integrated in space and the sharp contrast between figure and ground, aspects of shading and shadow give the impression of an overall illumination. Two viewpoints, one for the room, the other for the figure, are collapsed and unified into a single image. It is clearly a combinatory visual form. In spatial conception, colouring, pattern, and fracture, it reflects the conventions of historical Persianate painting. The arrangement of the body, the unique contour that defines its edge against the background, the handling of the face and hands, and the close cropping of the subject all suggest the mediation of a photographic image. The same compositional setting was applied throughout multiple examples of portraits of Nasser al-Din Shah and his courtiers. In this work, you see the ruler depicted in an interior from the 1850s. The painting is similar in many details, especially the stacked bolster cushions and the oval and end table carrying a bowl of flowers, to a portrait of Ardeshir Mirza painted by Abul Hasan Ghafari Kashani and dated in 1852 that you saw a few minutes ago. An inscription set in a cartouche above the sitter identifies the subject as the Sultan, son of the Sultan, Nasir al-Din Shah Qajar, while another at the ruler's feet provides the name of the artist, rendering by the slave of the court, Mubarak ibn Mahmud. So, Rakhmi Bandei Dargah Mubarak ibn Mahmud. The room is populated with many objects, a glass globe set on a gilded stand, two small jugs of flowers, an artificial floral arrangement under a glass dome, and a painting of a Napoleonic battle set in a gilded frame surmounted by a clock. Elsewhere, rich colors and patterns provide texture to the bolster cushions, the wooden trim of the window, the carved plaster window frame and walls, a hanging crimson drape, and the green carpet. The posture of Nasir al-Din Shah shares the same effects of recent images of Ardeshir Mirza, among others, a highly particularized contour that corresponds to a real body. This measure of reality is signaled also in the close treatment given to the mustachioed face and gloved hands. The face is built up from layers of wash and stippling that deftly model the facial features, the set of the ruler's eyes, and the careful calibration of difference between his barbered mustache, trimmed eyebrows, and shaved beard. Overall, the body of the ruler has the appearance of being cut out and inserted into an oft-repeated composition, a space customized through the objects that populate it. The painting combines a conventional Persianate pictorial practice with the effects of the photograph, principally the unique contour of the body shown in a relaxed and formal pose and the equally particularized features of the face, hands, and feet. The rich polychrome of the room contrasts the near monochrome of the face, a distinction emphasized by shifts in the factor of paint, the habit of making an image by the selective appropriation and adaptation of components of existing models, sutured together into new compositions and further distinguished by aspects of detail, handling, and coloring, were entirely normal procedures in Persianate artistic practice. Two other paintings offer a still more complex layering by showing interactions across and between mediums of painting, photography, lithography, and lacquer. These paintings manifest a profound attention to the individuation of subjects set in casual poses, figures caught in time and congealed for posterity. Ibrahim's portrait of Zili Sultan, Nasser Eddin Shah's eldest son, dated 1890 to 91, is an object designed to preserve the full affect of a photographic object and not only its mimetic properties. Consider the oval frame, outlined in red and yellow, resembling gold, the mottled corners of a trompe-l'oeil stone, the caption written in white nastaliq, as well as how the frame crops the subject. The format of the medallion portrait resembles a photograph, while the frame partly mimics the presentation cases used to protect daguerreotypes and tintypes. The painting is in oil and tin by a painter also known for his lacquer work, and there is some of the honey-toned and amber hues of lacquerwares found in this painting. Without direct access to the portrait, it's not possible to determine whether it's a painted tintype, or a tinted tintype, or a painted simulation of the optical naturalism of photography. Strongly evident in the face, hands, and background, and the nebulous mist of purples, greys, and browns that resemble a studio backdrop. The large format of the portrait, it's almost a meter tall, suggests that it's less likely to be a tinted tintype, but that is not entirely out of the question. If it is a tinted tintype, the large format brought the photograph into scale with the conventional size of presentation portraits executed in oil and canvas. The watercolor portrait of Haji Mirza Suleiman Khan, chief secretary to Zilla Sultan, is a virtual monochrome in black and blue, dramatically opposing the figure against a black ground. The stark contrast between the modes of execution applied to the head and hands and the drapery-covered body suggests a fusion of visual effects and techniques associated with painting, photography, and lithography. The artist, Abu Turab Ghafari, brother of Muhammad Ghafari, also known as Kamal al-Mulk, and nephew of the Naqashbashi Abul Hasan Ghafari Kashani, was trained as a painter and lithographer in the Dar al-Funun, and produced large paintings by commission and images for the newspaper Sharaf. As a painted watercolor, the painting carries the traces of reproductive processes redolent of both lithography and photography. Although the last two images come across as less connected to historical precedent than the other examples of paintings mediated through photographs, they force a discussion of history as longue durée, despite their conspicuous modernity. A lacquer pen box of the Safavid period, dated 1712 to 13, embodies what some art historians regard as the lamentable effects of exposure to post-Renaissance European art, an adoption that resulted in incongruous fusions, incompletely assimilated pictorial conventions, and the demise of traditional techniques characterized by fully integrated representational systems. From the early 1600s, Persian artists increasingly responded to European art, imported as panel paintings, portrait miniatures, and prints, to render a mode dubbed European style, Farangi-Sazi, in Persian. The pen box displays a composition of amorous couples set before a perspectival landscape, a floral border around the lid, the sides composed of portrait busts, and sweeping landscapes with Italianate and Persianate architecture. The importance of this example and numerous others of its kind lies in the evidence it offers of an earlier time in Persianate art when prints, another reproductive technology of the image, functioned as an intermediary of representation. The Persian artists engaged this visual mode in their production of lacquers and other media. On the pen box, the artist combined the dual modes of painted polychrome for details of clothing and flowers, and stippled monochrome for faces, exposed body parts, details of the environment. The pen box resulted from a creative process, a working methodology based on the use of models, drawings, paintings, prints, and the movement across mediums. While artists of the Qajar period continued to engage examples of Safavid art for their subject matters and styles, partial recreations of the aesthetic aspect of historical objects, and in an imitative intervisual practice codified in Persianate painting since the early 15th century, they also looked to the nearer past and contemporary times. Sources included the content, visual content of lithograph books and single sheets, newspapers, photographs, chromolithographs, and photographs. A host of subjects, compositions, modes of expression, and the new effective nature of some images, especially photographic portraits, characterized by descriptive detail and psychological intensity, manifest in the direct gaze and or facial expression, became available to Qajar artists from imported and domestic contemporary sources. Some of these were translated in the sense of being moved and changed to lacquer objects, with or without the visual traces of the original medium being preserved. The full-length portrait of a man on the lid of a pen box, attributed to artist Mohammed Bakir Sami Rumi, retains the traces of a photograph transposed onto the surface of the lacquer, where it's embedded in a system of modes of painting, ranging from the mimetic to the abstract. While the painted portrait relates to photography, other painted compositions, the landscapes on the sides, stem from the historical conventions of Persian lacquer painting. As yet, it's difficult to reconstruct fully the visual world of Qajar artists and to convey the intricate networks of image production between media, as lacquer objects simultaneously remediated a historical practice of Persianate painting developed in books and on objects, and waves of new media in the form of various kinds of prints, lithographs, and photographs. And these forms are often in themselves blended media. General observations of affinities of form and subject matter between media go only so far to explain Qajar artists' creative intersection in a 19th century world characterized by an escalating market for commodities and various regimes of mechanical production. From this expanded world of images, Qajar artists reconfigured prototypes into new arrangements and combinations, shifted their palette, and supplied infinite permutations of details to the basic outlines presented in a design. This form of production can be traced to manuscript painting since the 1400s. It's useful now to return to the criticisms of Rosh Hashuar because they actually illuminate key aspects of image production in Qajar times that no Qajar writer directly addresses. Rosh Hashuar took Qajar artists to task for their failure to distinguish between classes of images that were mapped against classes of consumer. After all, in Iran, artists treated with equal value lowbrow images used as shop displays in village wig stores or decorative accents in taverns and highbrow paintings by the likes of Raphael and Titian. They failed to make the appropriate aesthetic distinctions and also risked an association between their paintings and the world of commerce. The free process of sourcing imagery from various media and recombining them was also viewed with disdain by Rosh Hashuar and many others, who perhaps considered it as akin to the decoupage of Victorian-era scrapbookers, cutting out and excerpting ready-made compositions and fashioning them into new configurations, and hence also low class. And on the dissemination of lithography, this fruit seller stand, you can see the framed lithographs and photographs hanging in the back of the stand, whereas in this photographer's studio, there's a proliferation of different kinds of photographic and printed images from various sources on display in the studio interior. An aesthetic effect in production, the Qajar lacquers are similar to contemporary paintings that mediated photographs. Qajar works in paper offer an interesting parallel to the uses of photographs in late 19th century India, where carte de visite and photographs were routinely painted with opaque watercolor. There are examples of painted and tinted Qajar photographs, but typically They're sparsely colored with pigment, used to enrich details of pattern and texture without covering the entire surface. Similar treatments are indicated for lithographs. One example is a portrait of Muzaffar-ed-Din Shah, who succeeded Nasir-ed-Din Shah as ruler in 1896. The lithographic portrait has been delicately tinted with watercolor and set inside an elaborate frame composed of floral scrolls in polychrome and gold, resembling in its presentation historical albums of the Persian tradition. The practice of painting Indian photographs was both widespread and extensive, far exceeding European or Persian habits of retouching negatives or tinting prints. In India, paint was, quote, much more than a supplement to the photographic image. Rather, the overlay of paint completely replaces the photographic image in such a way that all or most of it is obscured. This is Christopher Pinney. In many examples, only the faces, hands, and feet of the human subjects are left unpainted. The resulting duality of modes, bright polychrome with pattern, subdued monochrome with subtle modulations of tone, in the painted photographs is comparable to the fully painted Qajar portraits that used photographs as one of their source media. Any assessment of the intersections between mechanical and handmade modes of image production cannot accept the argument that Qajar painters simply emulated and attempted to reproduce photographic models. Despite the observations of contemporaries that photographs afforded objective lessons in proportion, techniques of modeling and perspective, painters did not follow this instruction. Photography was assimilated into painting in a manner consistent with practices that had a long historical precedent, a deep structure in the habits of artistic conception and production, whether the one looks at the output of court-sponsored workshops or the bazaar. Rather than opening the way for an entirely new artistic culture and a break with the past, one of the effects of photography and lithography was to reinvigorate the historical practice and format of the painted portrait. In Qajar eyes, a form of progress and modernity. Far from being threatened by the reproductive potential of the new technology, photography was eagerly assimilated into an arsenal of techniques of artistic production founded on the use of models. Qajar artists across the social hierarchy preferred to engage their subjects through prefabricated images and not from direct study of life. Much like the print culture embraced by artists in the 17th century, the 19th century witnessed the eager reception of photographic and lithographic models in painting, as Qajar painters harnessed new technologies as a means of forging doubly indexical objects. Their paintings combined features derived from the photographic index, the trace of a sitter's real presence, with the modalities of Persian painting, and united them through the medium of pigment applied by the artist's hand. The real was a construct that remained coded in a network of pictorial conventions and heightened sensations of materiality, despite the promise of photography, as a supreme form of evidence. In translating the chemical residues of the photograph's monochrome into the painting's polychrome, subtle adaptations of the photographic source mutated its status from a reproducible image into a unique object fashioned by the painter's hand. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have time for a few questions and or remarks. I actually want to start you off with a thought. I mean, I was thinking about the Indian comparison, obviously, that you made somewhere towards the end, and you know, notably, if you think in terms of the work of someone like Mohammad Tawakkuli about, you know, the whole question of the relationship between Indian modernity and Iranian modernity in this period, and why they take these related but somewhat divergent paths. Now, it did strike me that there are two possible sort of Indian framings that you could go to. So one is the one which you indeed did go to towards the end of the 19th century. But there's also this other curious late 18th century moment in India. You know, when you have the British, the European academic painters coming in some numbers into India. And then you have this very curious play, which if you ever saw the Lucknow exhibition, you would remember that, for instance, there are these moments when you have a painter like Tilly Kettle coming in and making extremely academic European paintings. And then you have Indian painters playing with his painting inside their painting. Right? So we're not at the moment of photography yet, but we are at a moment of another type of conversation. And what is actually interesting is that for the longest time, this was simply set aside as bad taste.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit the problem of the fate of your Qajar artists. But we haven't yet arrived at the moment of the problem of bad taste being because it's the relationship between, let's say, the mechanical and the non-mechanical.
In the period that you're talking
In the 18th century. So let me try to sum up. The question which I'm wondering about is this, that clearly there are types of passage between cultures that people have relatively less difficulty in accepting. Mm-hmm. And then there are other types of passages that people apparently have had much more difficulty in accepting. Right? So one explanation is that that's because we're talking about the passage between media which are of very different technological orders. But surely that's not the only explanation, right? So what is it that's, in a way I'm asking, what is it that stuck in the craw, finally, when it came to people looking at this stuff?
For the period that I'm focusing on, what stuck in their craw were the issues that I've talked about.
Let me just maybe push you a little bit further, because I mean, it seems to me that we can now change, and in a way, this is what you're implying, trying to get us to do, to take a step away from that judgment, right? If I understood your exercise correctly, that's possible.
I spent an hour talking about that. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still trying to understand. I still don't quite understand. I mean, I understand what they were sort of accusing them of producing kitsch, more or less.
I mean, I went through all of this at the beginning of the talk.
Yeah,
I can go through it again. But there's the concern with the absence of judgment and the kinds of materials that the Persian artists are treating apparently with equivalent value,
mm-hmm.
that no European would consider in the same categories. So it's the incapacity of judgment,
mm-hmm.
and to make the kinds of discernments that European artists would make,
mm-hmm.
as well as, I think, an anxiety about the mixture of mediums that is happening so freely in the Iranian context. But the piece that you're worried about, that is a late 18th, early 19th century piece, is of course, it's important and it would be necessary for a complete study of the visual arts under the Qajars. But it's also something that our historians have dealt with a little bit more seriously. The Indian-Iranian access during the reign of Fat Ali Shah and the formation of Indianizing motifs that appear in lacquer and in paintings. So it's not only imperial images of the rulers that adopt some of the models that are developed in India through oil painting, but also the expansion of certain kinds of subject matters and genres into lacquer objects. But admittedly, it's not something that interests me very much for the material that I'm looking at, which is really a post. I'm interested in what happens to painting after photography. That's the main thing that I'm
okay.
Worried about.
Communicate my question, but maybe come back